any pressure, but she's passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety, so please help me welcome Carla.
Now I'm scared. My name is Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Carla.
Oh, good morning. First, I want to thank John and the committee for inviting us out here to share with you guys this weekend. I have had a really good time, and I know my husband has too, and I can speak for him because I know, not because we're codependent, but because I know. We've had a really good time with Ron, and he's a friend from way back. And, you know, we, like Doug said, we see him more out on the road. But we know there are people, we know what they stand for and what they do in their lives, the principles they try to practice. And while we don't see each other all the time or even talk very much, we know that if we needed to in the dark night of the soul, we could pick up the phone and someone like Ron would be there. Ron, for sure. And I know that there's a lot of that goes on in here. And I want to thank Billy for picking us up from the airport and for the company of Billy and Shauna all weekend. Just a breath of fresh air, just being able to, I mean, I just know to the point of obnoxiousness. I have, I have a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know they do too, and we have just been sitting around the table eating it up, you know. And the message of Alcoholics Anonymous comes from everywhere. The third tradition says all I have to do is be an alcoholic, suffer from alcoholism, and I am welcome. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the task of which I'm tasked with today is to carry this message. And the message comes in all colors, from all colors, from all genders. It comes wearing suits and shorts and flip-flops and pants. And it's no less respectable wearing a pantsuit than it is in to wear a dress, or it's what's inside. The benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing of Alcoholics Anonymous is inside. It's internal. And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't show up dressed inappropriately. I mean, there's a limit to that. I get it. I know. But it comes dressed in a comic book suit. Right? And so I don't want to ever let form overshadow function, you know. I don't want to be a campaigner, but I have to say what's on my heart and what I see. And when I came in here, the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I didn't have to be any more than I was or know any more than I knew. God met me right where I was, and He met me through you. You came talking to me, and I started, you saved my life. You saved my life. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. Before that, I never did anything for 28 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. And I had had spiritual awakenings. I had felt the Spirit. I've known that there is a great Spirit, a great power that runs in and around and through us since I was a very small child. But I could never establish any connection with that power. I couldn't stay with it, you know, and any challenge that came. I grew up in a kind of a messed up family, you know. Doug was right. When I go to his family's house, you know, I get a little sugar headache. It's a little sweet, you know. They didn't have to go to school to learn how to love each other. You know, they just did. They sang. His dad painted the family pickup the color of his high school. You know, it was that family. And my family was not like that. And we loved each other very much, but we didn't have a lot of tools. My parents came from a harsh background as well. So they passed on what they knew. And so I feel fortunate to be in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've gotten to be awake to that, and I don't regret my past. I have seen over and over and over, like it promises in the Big Book, that my past has been used to help people. You know, maybe not even avert misery, but to walk through it with somebody and let them know it's going to be over at some point if we stay sober. So glad to be here. And, you know, again, when we all come from different circumstances, that's what I'm talking about here. When I talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, there's a lot of circumstance that may not be yours, but underneath it all, underneath all of the situations and the places and the times, underneath it all, we all came into this room for the thing we have in common is that we all got to that point of alcoholism where we were either drinking or thinking about it. Drinking or thinking about drinking. I have a condition called alcoholism where once I start drinking, I can't stop. I can't guarantee if I'm going to have 2 or 22. You know, once I start. And when I stop, my reliance on alcohol, because alcohol did so much for me, when you take it away, it is all I can think about. So I end up either drinking or thinking about drinking. That allergy that kicks in when I'm drinking and the obsession that kicks in when I'm not. And if that's you, welcome. And like it's been said over and over and over in this weekend, you know, the first step is discussion. It takes about 52 pages in the big book to discuss the first step. That's how important it is. That's how important that first step is. And then in chapter 4 on page 44, in two little sentences, it wraps it all up again. If when you honestly want to find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Boom. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. And we have that here. We have a way here. And we can't guarantee the timing on it. Can't guarantee any of that. We just know that if you do what we do, you'll get what we got at some point. You know, and I love that because I needed something that I could walk around with. I needed something that went with me when I walked out the door of that meeting. I needed something that went to work with me because I was someone who couldn't be in the marketplace for long when I was out there drinking. I just couldn't. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, step by step, moment by moment, day by day, I found myself becoming a productive member of society. And all of that over 28 years has changed form, and my values about that have changed. And I found out I've had big jobs, no jobs, little jobs, you know. Found that if you can't do the little job, you probably shouldn't do the big job, you know. And if you can't be without the big job, then maybe it's time to go back to the little job. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, the benefits are internal. And those are the things that sustain me through those certain trials and rough spots ahead. So, but when I got here, I thought it was very important to figure out why I was an alcoholic. Is it my dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? You know, if you had my family, you drink too. I was pretty convinced of that. I told you yesterday, I couldn't wait to do that fourth step. Then finally, somebody was going to know, you know, if you had my family, you drink too. And I found out that gave me an inventory, but it didn't really make me alcoholic. And my mother was a single mother of two girls, and we moved around a lot for the rent. My dad left when we were pretty young, and he wasn't in our lives much for a while. And so I was a new kid on the block a lot at school. And I'm not one who'll say, you know, I believe that, you know, for a lot of us, I think everybody has ego, everybody has spirit, every human being. So the fact that I felt different at different times, sometimes that was situational. Sometimes I felt dark and fearful because things going on in my home were dark and fearful. I felt separated from people because sometimes things were happening that weren't happening to other people. But the ability to live through that and be okay with those differences, that's something I couldn't get over. But I, like I said, I was a new kid on the block a lot at school. And so whatever it was we were doing at school, I was a little bit social. So whatever it was we were doing at school, I wanted to do it too. I'd try it. I'm open-minded. You know, if we were doing academics, I wanted to know the answers. If we were running track, I wanted to do that. If we were playing softball, love softball, boom. You know, I started playing championship softball. I've got a little bit of a competitive bone too, which doesn't make me alcoholic. That's not exclusive to us. We got the Summer Olympics going on out there. I guarantee you those people aren't all alcoholic. You know, there's spirit in that. And there's just wanting to be a little bit better every time, you know. All of that stuff, but you know, like I said, me and mine, I put a little bit too much value on that. By the time sixth grade was over, I was tired. I needed a drink. You know, I had wanted to be the
want to be the first woman president, the first woman Major League Baseball player, the first woman to run a 4-minute mile, you know, that'll get to you when you're 10, you know. But the deal was, when I took a drink, it worked. And that does not happen to 90% of the population, right about there. We can argue about the percentage, but it's about there. You know, it doesn't happen to everybody. Even people who walked into the bars where I tended bar, not everybody in that bar was an alcoholic. Lots of people, hard drinkers. Some people used to watch old Hank come in and play a couple of games of Pac-Man every day like clockwork. He'd have two Budweisers and get up and go back to work, and I never understood that. Never got how he could do that. I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business, don't they? It was that summer going up into junior high right before seventh grade, and I was at my friend Leonard's house, and we were playing spin the bottle and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And now by the time I was at this age, I had had a lot of ideas about sex. A lot of ideas imposed on me, brought about, the environment, babysitters, boyfriends, a family member, you know, all of those things introduced to sex in various ways, some appropriate, some not. And besides that, it was a sexual revolution. And so women, you know, I've always been for women, you know, wake up. And so I've got all these ideas, but I've moved into a very conservative neighborhood. And even though we're playing spin the bottle, there were certain rules, unwritten rules I didn't understand, like good girls do and say they don't. You know, boys are players, girls are sluts. You know, I never did think that was fair. And that's what happened at this little game of spin the bottle. We were passing around a bottle of my friend's dad's whiskey and spinning the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. And I still don't think it's fair, if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me that the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get. And again, I just didn't understand those unwritten rules, and I didn't understand how to roll with the differences. You know, okay, so what? That's what you believe, that's what I believe. A lot of people just walk away and let that roll right off their back. But I just took it to heart, and stuff was not going well at home, and school used to be the place where it was my refuge. And now that's not so much. You know, it's kind of disintegrating there. Boys my age are looking at me funny, and so are the girls. And my pride kicked in after a while, after my feelings were hurt. I fight for a while to stay in, and then I let go. And I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom and hanging out with the other girls who were backing away from their lives, too. And we'd bring stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and hang out until after a while. School just wasn't working for me anymore. And, you know, these weren't the first drinks I ever took, but these were the drinks where I was really connecting the dots that alcohol did something for me I couldn't do for myself. And now I'm beginning to let it. It began to intercede in my life in a way that nothing else could, not spirit. And I had loved going to church. I had loved, you know, I was one of those kids that we'd go to bowling and then we'd go out to the bowling alley and stand in the parking lot and hand out tracts for Jesus, you know. It was just like that kind of thing. It was joyful and I believed. I just believed. But that all had begun to disintegrate over time. You know, even before I was drinking, you know, my belief or my ability to stay connected wasn't lasting. And I don't know about you, but my favorite place to be way back then was on my way to somewhere else. And I began to find my hope out on the open road. I began to go find those on-ramps of the 10 freeway coming east and the 101 going north, and I'd sit out there on the on-ramp and I'd stick my thumb out under the open sky and feel like I was taking my life into my own hands again, feel like I was in the solution, you know, sit out there and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd just be on my way to somewhere else, and I loved that feeling. I felt like I was solving my problem. I never made any big plans about what I was going to do when I got there. I just left. And consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hotspots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall and like that. And
You know, I know a lot of people come in here, and this is what I mean. And circumstances are just the outside dressing. Some people came in here later in life. My husband came in here later in life. Didn't even start drinking till later in life, you know. But at a very early age, I had begun to trade away every gift, every God-given gift or sign of potential or talent for the effect that alcohol produced. My self-respect, any kind of dignity, and I had some back then. That's a gift. That's something we're born with. I'm the one who trades that away. But alcohol did so much for me. It just seemed like, you know, the price was worth it. If you had asked me back then, I would have told you I was doing it willingly. When I was 14, I left home one more time with a friend of mine who, again, not making any big plans about what, but San Francisco, because of the summer of love and you know, the 60s and all of that, we kept heading for San Francisco, hearing about peace and love and flowers. And I really love that spirit. And so we're heading up north one more time, and we got one long ride all the way up into a place called North Beach in that area, a big party district, and got dropped off right in the middle of this party town. To my left was Carol Doda and her flashing boobs, and to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh my. You know, we're little kids, bright lights, big city. And when I look at 14-year-olds today, I think, dear God, you know, we were so lucky. And some kids aren't. Some kids were not that lucky. Some parent, you know, like my friend Sharon says, when an alcoholic gets sober, 10 other people sleep better. So we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about in the chapter of the doctor's opinion that after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one, and it certainly seemed that way for me. It just seemed the next indicated thing, one more time, one more time. And a year later, I was being admitted to a mental hospital. I was 15 years old, and everything, every kind of hope or dream or possibility that might have shown on my horizon were absolutely shattered, just shattered. And you might have thought, you know, I might have thought I was broken then. Apparently not, because I had another 15 years of drinking to do. But I was admitted to this hospital. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. I ended up being there for a year. Just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And there was also something inside me intuitively that wanted to stay. I did not want to go back home. There was just no solution there. I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30. And there was just not a lot of solution in our home and not a big amount to look for it. And even though I seemed to be the explosive kid and the one that the problem centered in, I was also the one who seemed to have gotten the most help. And during all that time being locked up, my dad used to say, I think they're just trying to buy you some time. And even though maybe it wasn't the accurate way of helping, it kept me busy, you know, for a while. And so I was in this hospital, and they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. This was a mental hospital, not a treatment center, and there weren't a lot of them around back then. And so a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real deal. They do exist. And untreated, when I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, and I've got no booze, it takes a while to sort that out. I look a lot like them. So they're giving me daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane Sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I'd become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I look like at 15. Alternately violent and withdrawn, living with a level of frustration down in my gut I didn't know how to talk about. It wasn't until I got to AA almost 15 years later that I heard a tape of who I now know was Cubby Selby talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh God, you know. It was a long time in between, though. If you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy, I've already told you, was the boys. I loved all the boys. But my favorites are those sexy, smoldering types. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer. And you just never really knew when they were going to blow. You know what I mean? Like, oh, God. I used to find them so exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. So
I stay away, keep my distance. I know we got some of those guys in here this morning. I see the smoke curling up from the corners. I know you're in here. But the trouble with guys like that in the nut house is that they were usually in there trying to hide from a junior prison sentence. You know, they didn't want to go to California Youth Authority, so they're trying to lay low, but they got nothing that keeps them low, you know. So eventually they blow. Like my first boyfriend, he ended up blowing, and he threw a big chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And my next boyfriend, he blew, and he threw a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And so that was progressive, too, you know. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on. Ron talked about that. You know, music is so sweet, it gets right to you. You know, like maybe some days Bob Dylan following you around singing a ballad, you know. The next day maybe a mariachi band, you know, just woo, a little fiesta. Some days you just like flat out rock and roll, you know, boom. You know, just setting the mood. And we used to play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, ooh, when will I see you again, you know. Press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit, looking out them, looking back at us. You know, living in that sweet spot of anticipation. You know what I'm talking about. As soon as I get that. If only. It's never in the getting, is it? As soon as you get it, you got to get another one. That one's not right. Not quite right. Not what I was looking for, not what I expected. So it's always that anticipation, that fantasy. I didn't know what I came looking for, I came looking with. I didn't know. My friend Rachel used to say, like a chicken standing on its dinner going hungry. You know, it's right here, deep down inside each of us. I didn't know that. Always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And the trouble with that is that I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I'm looking at anyway. I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it would dissolve where I stood because it wasn't it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. When I'm thinking of you, I'm not thinking of me. I don't have to try to put that great mystery that is me puzzle back together. But I didn't know that back then, so I'm searching. And I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window and he's gone. It's the last time I'm ever going to see him, and I'm heartbroken, you know, because this was a real relationship, you know, 2-3 weeks or something, and serious. And so I'm channeling Greta Garbo and watching this whole thing go down, smoking my tragic cigarettes. Just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," then just walk away. You know, I'd love, later on, I read in the big book that Bill says, we avoid the deliberate manufacture of mystery. We avoid that. We avoid that. I used to just sit right down in it, you know, give it some tea and hang in there for a while. And God, it took me a long time to realize I had been brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. You know, it's the way I saw my life. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. And every now and then throughout that year, I'd get thirsty enough to find my way over the fence or under the gate or however I could back onto the other side and out into the real world to go have a little party. And I'd get out there and I'd drink for a week or two. And then I'd come back in the front door of that place. Why? Because that's my home. I live in the nut house. By the time I got to this last unit, I had sort of started to surrender to the possibility that maybe I am just one of those little nut house lifers, that every now and then I get outside, but I am always, always going to end up back inside. Why? Because every time I get outside, I am back doing the very thing that got me locked up in the first place. And I don't see that. I don't see that. I just keep thinking, if I just get it right this time, if I just get it right, try it this way, try it that way. And I spent most of my adolescent life in one lockup or another, juvenile hall in between, sitting in front of a judge, waiting for placement, waiting for placement, waiting for placement. And the whole family, too, thinking if we could just fix Carla, we'd be all right. We're all going to be okay. I ended up in a girls' home at the end of all of that. And here's where I want to tell you again, you know, that I've always believed in a power greater than myself. I participated. I was born into a Southern Baptist family. That religion worked very well for my mother till the day she died. I am no, you know, and I've had my deal with rejecting religion and then coming full circle. And today I am an and person. I like science. I like spirit. I like Baptist. I'm all for it. Whatever is working for you, we do this and that and that and that because we are not separate. We are not separate, and like a teacher that I admire very much says, we're all just walking each other home. We're just all walking each other home, so whatever it is. But I didn't know that back then. I couldn't be free. I just had to find the right one, you know. I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade, you know, because I was very attracted to the ceremony. If you do it just right, you know, we'll get that, we'll get it. You know, little girls in white dresses praying with the rosary, I wanted that. And then I gave up on that, and I started burning black candles and praying to the other guy for a while, you know. just trying to hedge my bets, really. I just really wanted to be on the side that was winning, you know. And then the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you might remember that show. David Carradine played a Buddhist priest. And that guy was tough. You know, he walked the Wild West in bare feet. Just ever so elegant, you know, and he had that little bag, there's something on his belt, I don't know what's in that bag, but he looked pretty peaceful. And he'd walk from town to town, and because he looked different, he'd be assaulted by whole groups of guys, hostile, and they'd come up to him and they'd assault him verbally, and he'd stand there and just a few words, pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue, and you'd see their faces change. And they'd go off to help people right now, in an instant. I thought, that is real power. There's some power in there. And then he'd walk to another town, and this time he'd be met by another whole group of guys, only this time they'd assault him physically. Boom. And when they did that, he kicked their ass. And I wanted what he had. No, to me, he was strength and serenity personified. Isn't that what we're looking for? Lack of power. Lack of power is our dilemma. Whatever form that comes in. You know, and didn't we look for it in every form, in every way? And don't we still sometimes today? Many, many ways I've sold myself out. Many, many ways. So I get to this girl's home, and my friend, my roommate, she's on the same page. You know, I've got that Kung Fu combined with the spirit of the 60s and all of the music of the 60s, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Cream, Blind Faith, Traffic, you know, just the marching songs, the strength songs, the peace and love songs, all of that spirit. And we're talking to our friends, and our friend said, man, those people are in Oregon today. We said, Oregon? They said, yeah, San Francisco's gone to seed. Got to go to Oregon. And we're, man, okay, out the second story window of this girl's home, down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. Always went somewhere new thinking, fresh start, clean slate. We're going to get it right this time. We go up there. We ended up in Springfield, Eugene, Oregon, and my friends rented a house, and they let me come with them. And we're going to get back to the land, and we're going to start over, and we're going to get fresh and clean. And we planted a garden in the front yard, and that's where I learned that when they talked about hoeing in Oregon, they meant with a tool. It was a whole different deal. And I wanted to soften. I really wanted to soften and grow in the way that I saw my friend growing. But I'm an alcoholic, and two things happened while I was up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening. And Bill talks about that too in the book. He says that many of us were showing symptoms and signs of alcoholism long before we were ready, willing, or able to do anything about it. And so sometimes we'd go without alcohol because we had no money, and I was a terrible thief, and I certainly wasn't trying to go back to lockup. So we'd go without sometimes, and by that time, my reliance on alcohol was already such that when you take it away for any amount of time, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. And my life quickly becomes your fault, and I get very hard to get along with. A big pain in the ass, if you want to know the truth. And then when I could drink the way that I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark, and that was happening again and still at 17. And my friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. You know, the conversation usually went something like this, Carla, we love you, but you got to go.
And I ended up in a roundabout way at my father's house one more time. We hadn't been together in a few years, and I had just broken his heart over and over and over, and he used to sit up nights and wonder where I was, and so now he lets me back in for a little while, and that didn't last very long at all. See, he didn't drink, but he had a beautiful, beautiful liquor cabinet in his den, and every morning we'd get up at the same time, and he'd go off to work, and I'd go into his den and sit and drink from his liquor cabinet. And many days he'd come back home and see me sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that day, and I'd see that brokenhearted look in his eyes, and I have nothing to say for myself. No answers. I don't know about fear. I don't know about any of that. Can't answer, and I know I'm not going to stop. This is my only solution. Alcohol was my only solution. It was the best one. It told me I was okay. It told me it's all going to be okay. So finally he came to me right before my 18th birthday, and he said what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could remember is that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress, and I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there was not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I promise you that. 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me, and some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. Not a lot of hope about it getting any different. Every now and then I'd get rolled out of one of those cars I was getting in and out of and fall down, get up, take a drink, and just keep moving. A few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name, but I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who just came to mind very quickly and clearly after I'd done that inventory, you know, just like sometimes you just barely get done writing when you know what I did, know what I need to do to make it right. Even though he had problems of his own, he had never done anything but try to be kind to me. And I was like that proverbial tornado in his life, you know, just boom, spiritually, physically, emotionally, materially. So I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety, after I made those initial amends to my family and those closest to me, then I went looking for him to see if I might be able to find him and make those amends. And of course I didn't find him. I didn't know, I looked everywhere I knew to look, but I didn't know his last name. And it had been years. So my sponsor finally said, you know, you're going to have to let that go for a while. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. In the meantime, if you really want to change the way your life is going, then you could maybe keep doing what you're doing and then start by trying to be a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? And you know, that's not in the big book, but it's a good idea. And to tell you the truth, when I got here, I did not need a lot of convincing in that area, but I did need to know what it looked like. You know, I knew that you couldn't use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. I knew without using a dictionary what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization were. I knew that I didn't have self-respect. I knew that you did. And I knew that I didn't have the least idea as to how to get it. Moral and philosophical convictions galore, and I still can't get it for myself without you sharing that with me. And so she gave me these little ideas. I get vertical, man. How you doing? You know, these simple things. She showed me what it looked like. And all this time later, you know, I know what it's like. I experience self-respect. I have that. And nobody can take it from me. I can give it away, but you can't take it. See, these are the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. It was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. One of the most valuable pieces of information I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't feel like being here for the first 9 months of my sobriety, and I got to be here anyway. So I show up at this meeting and I give this talk, and of course I felt better. And when the meeting was over, the thank you line came through and this man stopped and he said, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. Now only a very well-organized, loving universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done under my own steam, couldn't make it happen. You know, I just like to tell that story, first of all, because it's mine. And we all get one. You stay and you do this and you'll all have one.
You know, again, I can't say this enough, man. The founders didn't promise us to have their experience. They promised us we get ours. It's very personal. It's something nobody else can argue with. One of my favorite stories, and I don't know if you'll get it, but I like it. It entertains me, so we'll just step back for a minute. And you know that show Gilligan's Island? I was a TV girl, too, and we used to watch Gilligan's Island, and you all know who that is, right? And Gilligan, the skipper comes into the lagoon and sees Gilligan flapping some palm fronds up above a palm tree, you know, he's, you know, floating. He's hovering there with these palm fronds. And skipper says, "Gilligan, what are you doing?" And Gilligan says, "Skipper, look, I'm flying." Skipper says, "You can't fly, Gilligan." So, of course, you know, Gilligan's power comes from the skipper. And he looks at him and says, "I can't." And he stops flapping and he falls to the ground. See, we get to believe our own experience. We can believe our own experience. I mean, check it out with your sponsor, you know. But you know what I'm saying. Anyway, that was mine. So I got to have that talk. I got to take him out for that talk and make those direct amends and tell him all that I knew. And then he told me what he knew. And a lot of his sentences started off with, "Are you sure you want to hear this?" And I said, "Yeah." And when we got done with that talk, he said, "You know, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And he's right. If we're in this room this morning, we are the lucky ones. And I say lucky because I believe that God's grace reigns on everybody. And I believe that those who have died, you know what? Sometimes God just brings the tired ones home. He just lets the tired ones come home. It's not a punishment to us. It's just, come on home, baby. I know. But somewhere along the line, each of us had to, somewhere inside the smallest breath, inside the smallest moment, we did something different. Maybe didn't even feel something different, but we did something different. We turned left instead of right. We ended up in a meeting instead of not. I went to my neighbor instead of the liquor store. Somewhere, something was happening. And like it's been said over and over this weekend, something is happening. Something is happening, something inexplicable. And maybe in hindsight, we'll be able to explain some of it. That's good. You know, we'll be able to tell the story. You know, how do you describe a miracle? We stand up, you know, it's not really fair to the newcomer. We stand up and for like an hour and some minutes and wrap this thing up like some bad episode of Law and Order. You know, we got the Law and Order, boom, we're good, you know. And the newcomer walks out going, "Whoa, you know, it only took an hour. Wow, how come mine's taking so long, you know?" But this is years. Years, and that's what the fellowship is for. The program is designed for living these steps. The fellowship, that's who walks us through it. We walk each other through going, "Yeah, well, I haven't had that experience, but Joe over there, he kind of did." And even if it's the same experience, you know, it's different in some ways. And we just keep going, "Yeah, but you can do it. We don't have to drink. We don't have to drink. Didn't our book promise job or no job, wife or no wife? You know, no matter what the circumstance, as long as I put my faith in a power greater than all of us, that I'm going to be able to go through." And here, the stakes, again, I can't say it enough, at least not enough for me, is that the stakes for me not living some kind of spiritually guided life is a drink, is the first drink. And if I take that first one, then it's going to take me. And that's why I'm here. I hope I never forget why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and for me, over and over and over, and in our book, it says over and over and over, it does mention alcohol. It says, it reiterates the stakes for us over and over and over. I read a lot of spiritual books, a lot of spiritual tradition, a lot of valuable information out there. But one thing that it tells me in our big book is that I will never be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol. Not on a bad day, not on a good one. And I need to remember that. So I stand at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and I watch the newcomers come in and I see active alcoholism all over them. And it reminds me that no matter what kind of good day I'm having today, what's happening with them is alcoholism, active alcoholism. And so I have recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body.
but I'm not cured of alcoholism, and there's a difference. And so I never want to forget what the stakes are. Because I'm not crazy over all these years. I get crazy. I can be, you know, weird and have problems, and, you know, they're of my own making, and look at things weird and get emotional and all that stuff. But at the base of that is a spiritual fitness, a spiritual foundation you guys have given me. That's all part of growing up. Anyway, I hope I'm not lecturing. I kind of am, I guess. But but it's stuff that comes to me a lot. You know, it's like, why am I? What am I doing? What am I doing? And if that's you, I'm glad. I hope you identify. This is what I'm doing here. And why I'm still here 28 years later, and why stacking chairs and pouring coffee and shaking hands and answering the phone still are not too high a price to pay. I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another guy from another rehab, and you know, that's where they keep the boyfriends and partners and whatever it is you're looking for. And and again, flying on the coattails of the 60s, loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And that's what we look like. Again, moral and philosophical convictions galore. Wanting to be a certain way, and I can't get there because I'm this. I got no tools. And so when the rubber hits the road and it's time to be somebody of character or something, or walk away from a fight, I can't do it. So we ended up living pitching a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass across town. Our spiritual advisor lived up the hill in the plastic tent, and he had invited us to live in this mining claim, this old burnout log cabin, where we threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And we had this little girl, and I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank, change the way I lived, really. You know, I'd had enough therapy to know we're going to break the cycle, we're going to change the way it was, right? We're going to be the parent I never had, and all that stuff. But alcoholism doesn't care about any of that. It doesn't care who you love or what your hopes and dreams are. We're drinking moonshine and homemade wine by then because it's organic and much better for you. And and she became second and third and fourth priority. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And my first legitimate work was in the bars, and it never occurred to me not to drink in the bar. Why else would you have that job? I just thought I was being very efficient. And my kid became one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And I can't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time, so we're living in the rent-by-the-week motels up there. And it's, you know, I love that little understatement that Bill says in there that we all have our own version of. And he says, gradually things got worse. And you know what I'm talking about, don't you? And we ended up renting a room for my aunt down in Covina, and I had a job in Hollywood, just about 35 miles away, and my daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd stop at the halfway point, which is a bar called the First Cabin, and I'd stop in there every afternoon on my way to the job and have my primer drinks, you know, those afternoon drinks, those shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Backs that got me ready to get up and go do my shift. And I'd go do my shift and pour drinks and drink with everybody to the wee hours of the morning and go home and start all over again. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye like I had been doing for months. And I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of gold and same Bud Backs. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I did not hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool and I drank those drinks and I couldn't stop. Not long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction, not to go see about the job or go back and see about the kid. I sat on the bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. They're gone. And I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area for about a month there until I fell into another job in another bar. And I had to stop calling to find out how my kid was because she kept asking me those hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And I had no answer for that. In fact, in my heart of hearts, I knew that she was better off where she was. Because stopping drinking was not going to be the answer, was not my answer. I know what happens when I stop drinking. So I got married to the man that I thought, you know, my best drinking buddy. We were pals, and we got married. I thought maybe if I made my life look like yours was, it'd be okay, you know, get the apartment and all of that stuff squared away, get the kid back, do that. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved in together, and we became the neighborhood entertainment. We settle our arguments with a shotgun, and whoever gets to the gun first wins. And that's how that went. And I went to my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs after one more of our fights. Our friend Mickey says it's not so much the yets that bothered him, but the oh no, not agains. We're fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool, and I lost that fight. Black eyes, broken ribs. He had to take me to the hospital first and then brought me back home, and he had to leave for work that weekend and out of town, and before he left, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. I'm drinking gin now because tequila had been making me so mean. You understand. And I started drinking and dialing the phone, and I don't know all who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life, and she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. So I called around, found an AA meeting. You know, perfectly wonderful meeting. Perfectly wonderful meeting. It was there then, it's there now. And I went there with everything but willingness, everything but readiness. And you can't give that to me. You can't make me ready. Nothing you can say to make me ready. And I went there, and people were very kind to me. I heard the woman talk. She talked, I remember it was a woman, and I remember the one thing I heard her say was that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer. So I did. After all, the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous said she switched to beer. Beer wasn't really drinking anyway. You know, it was, in my mind, more of a breakfast food. You know, when you think about it, you know, it's kind of healthy. It's got wheat and barley and hops. Kind of a whole grain breakfast food. Maybe shouldn't do without it, you know, at least a few a day. And drinking beer gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. It allowed me to get a little further into my day before I fell out, you know, so I used it. I just wasn't ready to let go. And my daughter, I got her back when she was about 8 and a half, and so for another year and a half, she was with us in that hell. And I got one little job at the end of that. I kept trying to get jobs I could get in, but I couldn't stay. Just get in, but I couldn't stay, and I couldn't stay sober. And I'd try to work at the bar even during the day shift, and I couldn't last past noon. I'd be so drunk, I'd have to have you come over and pour drinks and wash glasses and call that training. You know, and then I could go out in your car and take a nap. During my shift, I couldn't stay sober. And I got a little job working for the city, answering phones, and it was a really good job, and I really wanted to keep it. And so I started the torturous last year of my drinking, you know, where I'm either drinking or thinking about it in a way with an intensity that just I can't do justice to. But I'd get up in the morning, and I'd try to do without those morning drinks that would stop the shakes just so I could get to work and try to be normal. And without that booze, without taking that drink, then it was all I could think about until I could get to my break or lunch or however long I might last that day. Because when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about it all the time. And we had more of those catastrophes, more of those fights, and the cops at the driveway and all of that stuff. And finally, we had one more of those Saturday afternoons, the cops in the driveway one more time, the neighbors watching us one more time, kids now, she's almost 10 years old and she's standing in the corner scared to death one more time. The guns out one more time. And I didn't ask for that to happen. I didn't wake up thinking, let's do this. I woke up thinking, if everybody will just be cool, we'll all get through this day. So the cops left, they took the gun, the husband left for the last time, it's me and the kid and the booze, and I can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might stop, and they might look at their life and say, man, I am sick of this. Hard drinker might say, I need to get some help. They might even need to go to detox for a week or two, a hard drinker. And then they'd come home, and they might even have a story to tell. They may or may not tell it for the rest of their life. They'd get up and go back to work, and then they'd be fine. That's a hard drinker. What I did as an alcoholic was I sat down on the couch, pulled the 12-pack closer because I didn't have to keep getting up and down to keep drinking. Because you'd think that when the circumstances get bad enough, that that'll stop. You know, and please, not in sobriety. You know, we just up the ante. You know, some of us have kids in sobriety. Would I not drink for the kids? I hope not. I hope not. Our friend Carl Morris says he wouldn't take, that his kids wouldn't stop him from taking the first one, the first drink. Or he wouldn't trade his kids for the first drink, but he'd trade them for the second. You know, and we all get that, see, don't you? We get it. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. You know, the things just falling into place without me seeming to have my hands on it, coming together for the good of all, seemingly all. And the first one I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had seen and heard that whole deal go down that weekend. And she came over a couple days later, and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she sat on my couch, and she told me her story. And when she talked about her drinking, I heard me. You know, she was just a woman properly armed with the facts about herself. That was it. She shouted that she had an answer. I'd seen her walking around the whole year before. I'd seen her walking around. And I know she wasn't drinking. What impressed me more was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention. Because when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute, then I am restless, irritable, and discontent. I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my head closes in on me from there. It just gets louder and louder and louder, so much so that even though I know what I know by then about this alcohol, even though I know that I can't guarantee if I'm going to have 2 or 22 that time, you know, I know that. Even though I know that I no longer have to invite trouble that comes to visit unsolicited, even though I know that the window of relief has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, even though I know those things, I am not going to be able to, at some point, stop myself from taking that first one. And then it's on. So I don't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences are going to have any effect on me in the face of what I've become, you know? It just seems so weak, you know? We've heard them all before. They're not new. They're repackaged and really whittled down to the last so we can't argue with them, find our way through, loophole. Father Tom Weston, I've heard him say before many times, he says, you got to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. And I love that, because didn't it seem like it made more sense the last time? Did me. Okay, that sounds brilliant. So I don't know for sure that's going to work for me. I was surrendered to my illness, but I wasn't sure this was the answer for sure. And about a week and a half later, I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. It was a Friday night, a weekend, and I just didn't go back. I sat in the chair and I shook into the weekend. I shook and saw and heard things and shook into Monday and back into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober again. You know, here we are. Here we are. The jumping off place. Can't drink, can't not drink. And I went back to my neighbor instead of the store. I just did something different. I didn't feel different. I just did something different. It wasn't calculated. I just went. I went and I asked her for help, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California. That became my first home group. I went up there very, very, you know, I just didn't know, but I went. And I sat way back by the exit sign in the open door just in case. Just in case what? I don't know. And inside that room, I heard the hope. I heard the hope. I heard you guys talking, you being very kind to each other. You know, Norm Alpe used to say, everybody talking, nobody listening. You know, but yet we are. You know, asking each other, how you doing? Did you get a big book yet? Did you get a sponsor? How's that four-step coming? Do you need a ride home? You want to go to coffee with us after? How's your lawn, Joe? I thought, oh my God, a lawn. Could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? You know, fresh cut grass to just smell the simple things. It seemed like my life had been so far removed from that. It was all about foraging. Foraging for survival. I was well into sobriety when I found out that people go dancing to clubs for the primary purpose of dancing. Did you know that? One day, stood there looking around going, I'll be damned. Some stuff going on in here. The secretary did something very nice for me at the end of that meeting. She came back to me and she asked me if I'd read that portion of chapter 11, A Vision for You, that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, you know. And I took it from her. I said yes. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit. Just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do, even if I'm not in the room. Yes, I'll read. Yes, I'll lead. Yes, I'll pick up that newcomer. Yes, I'll answer the phone. Yes, help with registration. Yes. Keeps me in a posture of hearing and delivering the message. You know, those stacking chairs when my head and my heart and nothing can get quite match up. I come to the meeting, I start doing those simple things. I never know who's going to walk by me, newcomer, old timer, say that one-liner that's going to set me right again. Oh, yeah. I never know who's walking behind me, who's going to see me doing it and think if Carla can do it, maybe I can too. One of my favorite lines in the book is what seemed to be a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And my 28 years of sobriety so far has been built on a foundation of flimsy reed after flimsy reed after flimsy reed after flimsy reed. That's what I walk on. And I got a sponsor, and I was going to a lot of meetings. I went everywhere. I just wanted to eat it up, you know, and I didn't get it all, but I kept coming, and I wasn't drinking, and I was safe for those hour and a half. You know, I was safe. And the obsession had not been lifted. And I don't know about you, but I just, you know, people with 2 hours of sobriety coming in, oh, the obsession's been lifted. So happy for you. Good on you. That's good. You know, and I get that it happens, and I really am, you know, today I can say that, but for me it just wasn't, and I think it's important to say that too, because whether or not I felt like or thought that I should, I got to be here anyway. You know, and I don't know I'm sure you know what obsession sounds like. You know, it's just like following you around like that kid following his mom through the grocery store, you know, wanting chocolate. Like, mom, 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 mom. Let's have a drink, let's have a drink, let's have a drink on the way to the meeting. Just a little one, just a little one, won't hurt, just a little one. Have a drink at the break, have a drink when we get home. It's okay, nobody's watching. Let's have a drink, little one just to get you by. Just a little drink, just a little drink. 9 months. I drank one more time after 89 days. Because that first step edge was kind of coming back, you know. Like I thought a big book and a beer was a little more like balance. And I need to say that just for the, you know, to tell the truth. I was out for 24 hours. I had to finish that drunk. But as soon as I took those first ones, I wanted what I had had just a few minutes earlier, even with the discomfort, even with that. And it was important for me to know that. And I'm going to say it again because I think this is important, is that if you drink, it is never a matter of are you welcome back. You are always, always welcome back. Always, always welcome back. The question is going to be, can you? Can you get the traction? Can you come back in? I've seen over and over and over with a friend of ours who lost 12 years and it's taken her 17 months to get a little over 60 days. You know, to watch them try to get that back. Knowing full well how to do it, what to do, how it felt. Big, active in Alcoholics Anonymous. To know it and yet still. My sponsor picked me up that afternoon. I finished that drunk. I was finishing the beers when she got to my place. And my daughter, have you ever seen the look in the kids' eyes when they see their mother's sponsor come in? It's precious. Yeah. She thought, all right, Joanne's here. I'm going to throw these beers away now. Because the thing, and she's told me, shared this with me just about a month ago. She's 38 now. She shared with me, she said, when I saw that, she said, oh, no, not again. Oh, no, not again. Her heart, she was crestfallen. Oh, no, not again. So when she saw Joanne and she saw that I was going to the meeting that night, she was more than celebrating. And when she tried to grab the full beers, too, Joanne said, you can't do that, honey. And I finished those beers, and then I went to the big book study with Joanne that night. And that's the last time I ever had a drink. And that's the day I remember. And Dr. Bob's sobriety date is the date of his last drink, and that's the date of mine. The date of my last drink, that's the day I remember. My first day of sobriety, not so foggy. I mean, it's kind of foggy. The date of my last drink, I remember. And when I went into that meeting that night, nobody said, "Ew, I smell alcohol," in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Guy came up and said, "Hey, do you want to come up on Tuesday and make coffee with me?" And I thought, dang, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And I was, and I showed up on the days in between, too. And I found that these were my anchors. Coffee, making coffee was my favorite commitment, because I got out of work at 5 o'clock, and at 5:05 I was in that meeting, even though the meeting didn't start till 8:30 sometimes. But I was in the store buying stir sticks and coffee and creamer and trying to figure out who needs a birthday card and what am I going to do and how am I going to do and who likes what cookies. What? I'm thinking about you. I'm not thinking about me. And inadvertently started to experience the absence of the noise on the inside of my own head. And I wanted more of that. And while that was just the beginning, what we do in here, that's just the beginning. We've got to take these steps. But while we're waiting for that stuff to set inside us, we set the conditions for sobriety and a spiritual awakening by taking these steps. But in the meantime, we've got the fellowship and we've got these things we do. We sit together and help each other through. That's what this is. This thing right here, this is not the thing, although this, a lot of that's happening in here. This is the inspiration to go back out and keep doing what we're doing in the smallest, darkest corners. You know, character is built in the dark when nobody's looking. What am I doing when nobody's looking? So I got to stay, and I started to take these steps, and I took that fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, and six and seven, are all, they keep me awake, you know, and I realized my life is just driven by fear more and more. The longer I stay sober, the more I realize fear-driven. You know, we have a solution for that. But just even knowing that, what am I afraid of? Losing or not getting. And most of the time now, that's emotional. Emotional, you know, approval or being liked or something like that. Am I going to fit in? You know? And even now, every once in a while, I'm courageous enough in the morning to just say, enough already. Enough to you, fear. Enough. You've been chasing me around for a week and a half now with this crap. Enough. And it skulks away like a little bitch. But not always. But I like those moments, you know what I mean? When I realize we are free, we can be free in this moment. It's not a lot of hooey, but it takes practice. You know what I mean? So, I made that first round of amends to my family at about 9 months sober, you know. And it was the first declaration of what I did, what I need to do to make it right, what they told me they needed from me to make it right. Long period of reconstruction ahead. You know, still to this day, 28 years later, there's not a member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, "No, please don't go to the meeting." You know, never knew that. Never, ever happened. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you again, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redemption, I see forgivability, I see lovability and hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. You reflect back to me who I am, who I've been, who I want to be, what we're doing, you know, all just walking each other home. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody. And she's 11 years old. She's starting to come home at all hours of the night. If she comes home at all, she's beat up and bloody. She's been jumped into a gang, starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. I'm getting worried about her because I know what that is. And, you know, she's 11 years old. She's got 18-year-old vatos crawling in and out of her bedroom window, and she's 11. And so I had to get her some big help, and I wasn't sure how to do it. I talked to a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, had a lot of help. You guys welcomed her into the meetings when she had to come with me, helped her with her homework when I couldn't. You know, you were there. But now she needed something bigger. And at the time, you know, I was working at this new place, and I had this new insurance, and I went to this treatment center who, oddly enough, they were helping kids who had this. They didn't know if it was alcoholism or drug addiction. She had been experimenting, but certainly they didn't know if she had the allergy of alcoholism. And she hadn't been doing enough drugs to seem addicted, but she was in this gang. And they said that the gang influence at that age was 1,000 times more toxic than drugs and alcohol on a kid. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but they were getting them, you know, because of that feeling of camaraderie and I'm going to back you up. What is that power? Lack of power. And she wasn't getting it in her family. I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and while she was glad I'm sober, what does it say on page 19? It doesn't wait till page 103. It says, a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. It was time for me to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and go to work, go home, go do a meeting, and then come home and be a mom to that kid. Now, never, ever once have I ever said stop going to meetings. I've had people come up after why do we stop going to meetings? I didn't say that. But I had to stop going to 2 and 3 a day and start to turn what I've learned bring it home. And little by little, we got better. She was in that place 6 months, and I went when they asked me to. I stayed away when they asked me to, and she told me how she loved me, and she told me how she hated me. And it was for me to do that. It was for me to offer her that, whether she ever wanted a relationship with me or not. One of the most valuable things I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was how to tell my daughter that I was wrong about something. Was wrong, and not because I said so, you know, that not because I said so, Mom, but to learn how to talk with her and to listen. You guys taught me mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, and every day I just get up and give her my best spoonful. When she got out, we were better, but weren't perfect. She wanted to go live with her dad for a while. And while she was gone, I was, you know, continue to go to work and do what we do. You know, it's just that same teacher says, chop wood, carry water, chop wood, carry water. We do what we do. We go to AA, we go to work, we pay rent, we show up. When I was 5 years sober, I went home after the gym one night and I went to bed as usual, and I woke up in the middle of the night. There was a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, don't say a word or I'll cut your head off. And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. And I got to tell you that at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. Thank God, my friend Susan, when I got here, you know, it was just all about like what's God supposed to look like and all of that stuff, you know. And I was pointed back to those lines in the book, you know, God is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? And she said that, you know, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? And I could do that, you know, start here, right now, right here, right now, and then walk into my life. And if God is everything, like I believe he is, then there's nothing else. No place in the world I can be where God is not. And that came to me that night. There's a man on my back in the middle of my bed, in the middle of my room, in the middle of the night. And I don't know how this is going to turn out. I've got fight or flight going on, but I've also got some sense of peace. And I don't know what that is. I said a little prayer for my daughter in case she had to hear some bad news about her mom. Somebody please be with her. And then we quickly returned to me because I wanted to, you know, see what's going to happen. And at a strategic time, a couple hours later, I was able to get away for a minute and I ran to the front door and my own bolt lock kept me in. And so we had to end up in a little wrestling match, and I really thought it was over by then, or I thought I was over. And instead of getting more angry, he kind of panicked. And he got up and he went out the same kitchen window he had come in. And he left the knife on the counter. And it turned out that I knew him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. This is the difference.
Spirituality is everywhere. We're not the only ones. I hate it when I hear people say, oh, well, too bad they don't have a spiritual program. How do you know? What we do here is we take spirituality and we shoot it right at alcoholism. That's our primary common purpose. We have done a lot of other things. I've taken a lot of drugs. I've done a lot of those other things. I'm a fallen woman. I'm a woman who wears pants. But the thing that we all have in common in here, if you came looking for the shingle to say Alcoholics Anonymous on the door, is that torturous condition of alcoholism, where we're either drinking or thinking about drinking. And make no mistake, I was taught that it has a lot to do with alcohol. That's what's at stake here. And yes, there is so much more to do than just stop drinking. So much more. But those are the stakes. That's why I'm here. Anyway, there's a soapbox is growing under my foot again. There was a trial that followed. They caught him a couple weeks later, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband. And he was more inclined to testify on behalf of the rapist than he was for me. He's never been interested in any of my amends, and it has to be okay for a while, like I told you yesterday. And then so we had to get a character witness for me. And by that time, I was working at a big fancy place downtown Los Angeles, a place I never even would have walked in the front doors of years before. And now I'm walking undetected. You know, people like Henry Kissinger are walking the halls of this place, and I am undetected. They can't tell where I used to be or what I used to do, because I'm doing my job here. You told me to show up and do what they ask you to do. So the department head there volunteered to come and testify on my behalf, and they told him all about what I used to do and who I used to be, and he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was, and see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. My sponsor, I had gotten a new sponsor. Up until then, I'd had my sponsor, Lee, and my first sponsor left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked Lee to be my sponsor, and the women were still not lining up to have the privilege of sponsoring me yet, and I don't know why that was, but Lee was a good old boy, you know. He was just very, very simple. He'd say things like, well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting, you know. Now, he didn't say that about this, but, you know, you get me, but he knows that sponsorship isn't ownership, and he helped me. He came and made my apartment safe again and put double locks on the windows and everything. And then he walked me right up to my new sponsor, Marguerite, and she helped me. I always say Joanne and Lee gave me my life, and then Marguerite introduced me to my soul. And she said, you know, you're going to have to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. But God, the guy has scared me. And at 5 years of sobriety, fear, my best answer to fear was still anger. You know, it made me feel safe. It made me feel like I had a momentum, like you couldn't hurt me. And yet fear at 5 years of sobriety or anger at 5 years of sobriety is like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry, can't not be angry. So I stand at the turning point one more time. And that seven-step prayer became my mantra. Change me however you want. Here I am, you know, trying to let go, trying to see, trying to take that opportunity. If I ask for an attitude adjustment, it sort of behooves me to go out and try to have one, act like I've had one. So we get to court, and it's my turn to witness, and I look out, and I see him sitting at the defense table, and that's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And what started to occur to me was that little prayer we say at the top of page 67, though we didn't like their symptoms or the way these disturbed us, they like ourselves are perhaps spiritually sick. He like me is perhaps spiritually sick. You know, we don't ever forgive from a spiritual hilltop. We forgive because I am just like you. You know, and sadly, and you know, a little bit to my dismay, over 28 years of sobriety, I have discovered that I have been, or could be, or am being, just about everybody I've ever resented. And those are the seeds of compassion right there. Those are the seeds of compassion. And it struck me. And
So I believe that the forgiveness came. The healing took a little longer, and I'm even looking back, I think that I tried to heal a little faster than I really wanted to be okay. I really wanted to sing the song of triumph, and I stumbled a little bit over that looking back, and I don't have time to go into all that. It's only interesting to me anyway, but I had a lot of help, and I mean, my sponsor and lots of people were in that courtroom, including my father. He was sentenced to 20 years. He did 17, and he's not been able to stay sober or out of prison. I know that they do, though. I visited those prisons and talked to those guys and even seen some of those guys come out longer sober than I am. You know, they got sober in there, and they stayed sober, and now they're sober out. And I know that they can. I know it works, but he's not, as far as I know. And the detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And I've made my own troubles over throughout sobriety. You know, I've been bankrupt at 10 years sober, and I've had a lot of joy. You know, I've got the big job, had the big six-figure salary, and then left there because I just couldn't do it anymore. I wasn't educated enough to fix it, and I couldn't be a part of it, and I left. And, you know, I've been a chauffeur, I've been a Zumba teacher, I've been an insurance salesman. Look out! And, and now I'm a massage therapist. I worked at Home Depot long enough, and with the support and love of my husband, I worked at Home Depot. That became my monastery. My whole 11-step deal man up. We up the ante all the time, you know, all the time. We let these sure troubles and rough spots drive us in, not out. So I'll just tell you quickly. My daughter, she's 38 years old now, and she. She's just a beautiful woman. She's a beautiful woman and a better mother than I ever could have been. I was present at the birth of my first grandson, and I've gotten to be part of both of my grandsons' lives. The oldest is at Arizona State now in his senior year. The youngest is his second year of high school. And I sat with my new husband and my father and the rest of the family. We watched her just a couple of years ago collect her master's degree. And then when that horrible bloody mess happened in San Bernardino just a few months ago, that terror tragedy. She was on the crisis impact team with the San Bernardino Police Department, who went in the aftermath and helped those families start to put the pieces of their lives back together. That's who she is. And I don't know if she's who she is because or in spite of me. I don't think it matters. But as her mother, I get to be as her sober mother, I get to be a privileged witness to her progress and to the life that she led and to the lives of the women that I sponsor. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well and he knows why. You know, when he used to have to tell me this story for a long time, you know, that he knew it wasn't rational, but if he watched the news that night when people like the Green River Killer and the Hillside Strangler and all those guys were out running around, if he watched the news and didn't hear my name called, that he could allow himself to sleep at night, and that doesn't happen anymore. And my mother, when she died almost 7 years ago, we were clean and clear. And so much so that when my stepfather, her third husband, found out that Doug and I were getting ready to march down the aisle, he called me and he said, I know that your mom left you her wedding ring along with some other stuff, and what I'd like to do is shine mine up and give mine to Doug so that the rings will be together again. And so those are the rings that we wear when we got married. And We got together when we were both 21 years sober. I was 51 years old, and so I'm really glad I didn't stand around, tap my foot, waiting for that one to happen, you know. thinking I can't stay sober without a husband. What the hell? Just rolling with the tide, rolling with all of it, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has just put me on the game board. And some of the things that happen I like, and some of them I don't. But you're giving me a strength. And the things that happen, you can't write this stuff. You know, you allow me to walk awake and alive and looking you in the eye with a little bit of self-respect. And again, nobody can take this from me. I'm the only one who can give it away, and it's the same for you. If you're new, I hope that you stay and just try this on. Try it on. Keep trying it on. Doesn't matter how you look in here. It matters that you stay. Thanks for letting me share.